Forward Guidance is brought to you by VanEck, a global leader in asset management since 1955. You'll be hearing more about VanEck ETFs later on, but for now, let's get into today's interview. Very pleased to welcome back to Forward Guidance my friend Lawrence McDonald, New York Times bestselling author and publisher of the Bear Traps Report. Larry is the author of the brand new book, When Markets Speak, which I read, I enjoyed. Larry, your previous book was more about looking back at history, at collapse of Lehman Brothers. This is looking forward about what the next decade and decades are going to be like and how they're going to be nothing like what you and I have experienced over the past decades. Disinflation, expanding central bank balance sheets, a unipolar world. Larry, just paint a picture for the audience of how you imagine the next few decades are going to be like in the world of macro and why that's going to matter for investors and really everybody.
Really appreciate the shout out. One of the things about this book is we run a conversation on Bloomberg with institutional investors in 30 countries. And over the last 10 years, we work with professional investors, hedge funds, mutual funds, pension fund managers around the world. And what I'm trying to do with this book is democratize information. That's why you got to read this book, because if you want to know what really happens behind the scenes, how we formulate ideas, mosaic research, Jack, is like taking a piece of information or a thesis and then surrounding it with other pieces of information to make it stronger or weaker, right? So you can identify weaker investment thesis versus strong one. And what I've noticed in the chat the last, you know, two, three, four years is the amount of people that are focused on a more sustained inflationary regime that are really smart investors that we trust, that we know, that group of people is growing. So there's more people in the conversation. This is like an institutional chat, a conversation. It's like a live ideas dinner. And that's our business, the Bear Traps Report. And the more people are looking at hard assets versus financial assets. So they're looking at uranium, oil and gas, metal, all kinds of different metals, in the types of metals that will basically be the foundation for our future in terms of our power grid, in terms of our energy sources, in terms of how we actually, you know, fulfill a lot of these expectations, like artificial intelligence, like we can get into.
And so if you already, you know, ask the top two or three or more reasons for this inflationary epoch that you imagine going forward, why is inflation going to be high and stay high? You know, inflation peaked in the US around 9%. It's now at 3%, giving a lot of wind to the sails of the disinflationists. Number one, I mean, how high do you think inflation is going to sort of stabilize at? Are we talking 4%, 5%? And again, back to my first question, what are the major reasons for why this will be inflationary time ahead?
So in my first book, it's now in 12 languages. It's a New York Times bestseller. A colossal failure of common sense. It was voted as a top 20 all time at the CFA Institute, top 20 book.
Very good. I enjoyed it. I read it. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you. And so that's the reason why that's important is when I was at Lehman, I was a trader in the high yield distress businesses. And the fiscal and monetary response, Jack, to Lehman Brothers, right, was about $4 trillion. And that's fiscal and monetary response. We had an austerity period after the 2012 election where, you know, Republicans and a lot of people on the Hill were really responsible around spending, right? Or overly, as some people would say, and not responsible. And so some people would say like over, you know, I guess too much response. What do you want to say? It was an austerity regime in the U.S. We had an austerity regime in, don't forget, Greece, right? So we had all these austerity regimes. And, you know, now we're in a period after COVID. Think of COVID and the Inflation Reduction Act, everything that's come out of Washington, fiscal and monetary response is $16 trillion. So Lehman Brothers, $4 trillion, $16 trillion fiscal and monetary. And then we have a more multipolar world. So not only do we have, you know, four times the fiscal and monetary in terms of trillions of dollars more, but we also have a more multipolar world. A world with more conflicts where the people don't trust the supply chains anymore. People want to reshore. Companies want to reshore. The Biden team saw what Trump did with, you know, kind of reshoring and bringing manufacturing back and promising to bring those jobs back. Biden's basically picked up the Trump torch in that regard. You see, that's what some of this semiconductor the chips legislation, you know, all these many different types of legislation that are just attempting to reshore jobs because of this populist movement in the United States. All of that's inflationary. And if Trump wins the next election, you know, tariffs, Biden kept the Trump tariffs, that's inflationary, right? The power of labor. Labor unions are, I think, 2 to 3 times stronger today than they were, say, 2010, 11, 12, 13. So you've got all these sources of sustained inflation that are coming at us. And now you have, in a multipolar world, more conflicts. We've got two wars. And Neil Ferguson, when I sat down with him years ago, he's the one that opened my eyes to this. He said, Larry, wars are the most, like, think of the Vietnam War. Wars are inflationary. We had that incredible inflation in the 70s. And so we've got drones, Jack, drones that are taking out ships in the Suez Canal. They're taking out 2 to 3, 4 refineries in Russia in the last, you know, last month. And so all of those things are inflationary. So we're coming into this more sustained inflationary regime. That's why you got to read this book, When Markets Speak, because trillions of dollars, we're talking about a multi-trillion dollar migration of capital, and nobody's prepared for it.
A migration of multi-trillion migration of capital from where to where, Larry? In this time that you envision of high inflation, what assets perform well and which don't perform well?
Think about the last commodity bull market, say 2008, 2014. At one point, the energy sector was the same size as the NASDAQ 100. So the energy sector was about the same size as the NASDAQ 100. Today, the NASDAQ 100 is 18 trillion larger. Okay, 18 trillion larger than the energy sector. NVIDIA itself is 5% of the S&P. That's in artificial intelligence, 5% of the S&P. The energy sector is 3% of the S&P. And so everybody's long what we call financial assets. They're long growth stocks. Nobody's really long hard assets or commodities. They're massively underowned because everybody's looking back at the previous regime. Everybody's looking back at Lehman and COVID in that period of disinflation in the post-Lehman world. And now we're coming into a 1968 to 1981 regime where different asset classes outperform.
So you think that hard assets and commodity-like stocks like energy will outperform and beat growth stocks? And correct me if I'm wrong. So the major drivers of this inflationary period that you see ahead of us is strong labor, very robust fiscal and monetary stimulus. So basically money printing, specifically from the government, a multipolar world. What do you mean by a multipolar world? And then also, does it have to do with reshoring? Basically making stuff in the US is more expensive than making things in China. And over the past 30 years, we've seen the proliferation of globalization, which has been disinflationary because countries with very low costs have been producing more and more stuff. And you envision a reversal of that. Is that right?
Yeah. Well, think about COVID, right? COVID burnt, the supply chains broke down. So right there, thousands of CFOs around the United States, around the world, were burnt. And they were because they didn't have a backup supply chain. They basically were too tied into, it was complacency, massive complacency, where they were too complacent around, okay, these supply chains are going to be smooth as silk for a long period of time. That's deflationary. In a world where the supply chains, like think of what's happening in the Suez Canal, think of what's happening with Panama Canal now, with just the water tables, think of what's happening all around the world. It's the supply chains just aren't working as well. And not only that, we've decimated the Rust Belt in the United States. We've taken 5 million jobs out of the United States, and we've sent them all over the world to India, Bangladesh, China. And so we've raised that standard of living around the world. And so energy consumption globally, I mean, if you're in India in a call center, you might make 10, 20 times more than your great grandparents. So your energy supply has been constrained by lack of investment, by ESG and things like that, which and just regulation. So your supply of energy and metals has been suppressed. But your demand, which comes from, countries like I said, countries like India, your demand is really exploding. And we've calculated if you take the 2010 to 2014 regime of what we call, commodity bull market and investment, we're about $3 trillion behind that previous path. And so that's, you know, pretty daunting. And the last thing is this, just that the stocks you want to own, this is why you have to buy this book, When Markets Speak, because the stocks you wanted to own, the stocks that commanded the larger part of the market, instead of the 60s, 70s, 80s, each decade have been very different. And so in disinflationary regimes, your big cap growth stocks, you know, your Apples, your Microsofts, they typically do really well in disinflationary regimes. Whereas in inflationary regimes, you know, your General Electrics, your industrials, some of your oil and gas, you know, Exxon was the largest kid on the block for a long time. And so the makeup of the market changes dramatically over the last like 50 years. And we think we're on the cusp of a colossal migration of capital based on that shift.
Let's, how high do you think the prices of commodities can get for, you know, for example, oil, the peak in 2008 was about $140, I think. Now it's at $80, which is high, but, you know, still below there. Copper, you know, it's pretty close to its peak. It's about at about $4. How high do you think that they go? You know, gold now over $2,000 an ounce. How high do you think they go, and how long do you think they last? Because also, I'm curious if you agree with this. I mean, commodity bull markets are, by their very nature, transitory in the same way that, you know, nothing lasts forever. But also, if copper goes to $10, probably there's going to be a huge investment boom in copper, and then pretty soon it's not going to be at $10 anymore. It's going to be, you know, and often basically the point of typically shortages create oversupply, and, you know, we may have seen that in oil, at least cyclically, where, you know, you had a huge spike up to $120 in 2022, and it's since gone down there a little bit as U.S. production has gone down. So, you know, what is sort of the scale of this commodity bull market that you envision in terms of how high things go? Pick the commodity you want. I mean, we didn't talk about uranium yet, and how long it lasts.
Well, everybody's 401k, like the entire 401k ecosystems of America, that system is massively long the same trade. Everybody's in the same stocks. Everybody's in growth. And when you think about commodity bull markets, it's like turning around an aircraft carrier. You know, if you just think about CFOs in the natural gas space, chief financial officers in, say, the copper space, they've all been like, they just saw their last five bosses get shot because the investments that they made from 2000, say, 10, 11, 12, you know, to 14, you had a pretty incredible bull market in commodities. Then there was overinvestment, and a lot of these CFOs today saw their previous bosses get shot. So we're massively underinvested in say copper, oil, and gas. There's a lot more capital discipline, and on top of that, the politics. I mean, just look at Panama. Panama has one of the most, this first quantum company. This is one of the most incredible copper mines in the world. You can get copper out of the ground, you know, to the ocean from the mine very fast. And whereas in other parts of the world, like in Africa, it takes a long time. The politics of Panama shut that mine down. And it's one of the most profitable, productive mines in the world. Seeing the same thing in Chile, same thing in Peru, to some extent, not the same violence. But it's just, you've got this suppression of investment through regulation, through really intimidation, politically bad politics. And so that's why these commodity bull markets, Jack, can run for like 3 to 8 years, because to get that uranium, to get that oil and gas, I mean, it's going to take at least three, the case we make in the book, at least $3 trillion of investments across all those areas. I mean, just look at artificial intelligence. I mean, we have a 50-year-old power grid in the United States in some spots, 30 years old in others. And we're supposed to take artificial intelligence, which is, just think about the computing power of these data centers. You're talking about 490 terawatt hours in 2022. And if you believe NVIDIA, if you believe their management team, that's very boastful, very aggressive projections, if you believe the Wall Street analyst about artificial intelligence, then you're going to talk about energy demand or energy consumption going from 490 terawatt hours to 2000. And on a power grid that's that old, and on solar and wind, no way. The only way to get through that is with gas and oil and gas and uranium and nuclear power.
What about coal?
You know, met coal is more made for steel making. And so steel is very important. Copper is the most important for the grid. But just think of the rebuild of the Ukraine. What's crazy is the rebuild of the Ukraine is going to basically coincide with this artificial intelligence boom, you know, this boom in crypto. You know, everybody loves to talk about crypto, but nobody's talking about the energy solution of the computing power needed when crypto gets up at a higher price. So, yeah, so steel, you know, you've got different types of steel. Different types of coal and different types of companies like Arch Coal. And Arch Coal is more of a company that focuses on coal that's used for electricity. And so, yeah, so coal stocks, they're still extremely cheap relative to free cash flow. And so all these plays really they're underowned. ESG and regulation has dramatically forced, a massive underinvestment and massive under ownership of a lot of these asset classes.
What kind of prices are you think are ballpark for oil, which, you know, again, the peak in 2008 was 140, copper, which is, you know, close to its peak at $4. I mean, do you think we make new all-time highs and they stay there? How far can this go?
Well, oil itself, the underinvestment in oil and gas is probably the most exciting right now. It's under $2, and gas is, I mean, with the LNG revolution around getting LNG into Europe and just the old demand from artificial intelligence, gas should go from $2 to $8 over the next, like, 5-6 years.
So you're talking about natural gas, not gasoline, just to be clear.
Yeah, natural gas. And then you're talking about oil. I mean, oil, the last time, right now, the Nikkei, if you think of like the last like couple months, the Nikkei was at all-time highs. The Italian stock exchange and the French stock exchange were pretty much near all-time highs. The last time those markets were at all-time highs, oil was like $140 a barrel. And you've got, you know, there's a billion people in India that don't have air conditioning. If you do, you know, we've done a lot of work in the book, When Markets Speak, around diesel demand in India, moped sales last year, fourth quarter. I mean, if you're a young person in India and you've raised your standard of living, the Davos crowd, these guys, this is a horrific, potentially catastrophic miscalculation. They've, like I said, they've taken 5 million jobs out of the United States. They wanted to globalize, right? These are globalists, okay? It's a good thing, right? They meant well, right? But catastrophic mistake, because you've raised the standard of living in India. You've raised the standard of living in Africa. You're creating massive carbon consumers, and these people can't afford, solar and wind yet. These different countries, they can move it in over slowly over time. So gas and oil are going to fill that void. Uranium, nuclear power, we've been writing about that for years. The entire uranium sector, Jack, it's like $48 billion. I mean, that's like a bathroom rounding error inside of NVIDIA, you know? I mean, it's just a joke. And so uranium probably triples from here.
From here. So, right, it's around $100 USD, maybe a little bit less than that. You think it goes to $300?
Yeah, over the next 10 years, I think I get a very good shot at that. Which, if you just look through the math on the amount of plants coming back online in say, Japan, and the amount of the situation in the United States in terms of, if you look at the different legislation in the U.S., Washington's waking up to this problem. We have a big uranium production problem. And so there's going to be a massive rebuild. And then nuclear is the most green fuel in the world. And then if you look at, copper, huge bull market coming, nickel, huge bull market, aluminum's your kind of your cheaper source for metals, for say the grid. Like I said, the grid alone is a $2 trillion project. And then you have this rebuild in the Ukraine. And so you've got this just colossal amount of demand coming the next 10 years. And aluminum is a big winner in any kind of rebuild in Europe. If copper is too expensive, then aluminum comes in on the grid. And so that's where I see just tremendous opportunities.
So you're a massive commodity bull. And it sounds like you think that India over the next decade is kind of going to be like China was from 2000 to 2008 in terms of just devouring a tremendous amount of commodities to fuel its investment-led growth model and building buildings and that kind of stuff. Is that fair to say, Larry?
Yes. I mean, like I said, we've taken the 5 million jobs out of the United States. We've decimated the Rust Belt. There are fathers in the Midwest that their father, their grandfather, their great-grandfather all worked at General Motors, you know, and now they're working in restaurants. And they're going to the library at home, they're embarrassed, or they're on disability. I mean, opioid, this, just look at, Jack, look at life. Look at what the United States spends on healthcare. We literally like 2 standard deviations greater than any country on earth. And life expectancy in many parts, and we looked at this carefully in the book, life expectancy in the Rust Belt, in the many of these states that Trump won, life expectancy has gone down, Jack, down, because people are dying in their 50s because they can't make enough money to support their family after inflation and taxes, or they lost their job, or they can get a job, but it's in a totally different industry than they've been accustomed to. And so you've emasculated the middle class in the United States. That's what inflation does, right? And so that creates, you know, just this really difficult environment for a lot of people that make, you know, less than $100,000 a year, less than $70,000 a year. And so that's created this, the political push from both Biden and Trump to bring jobs back to the United States, which is inflationary.
And how does this affect China, who has been producing a tremendous amount of low-cost goods for the rest of the world and amassed a huge surplus of currency reserves as it ran a trade surplus, a current account surplus? They used to invest that in U.S. treasuries. If the rest of the world is reshoring, what is the future of China's economic growth model, or how might it have to change if it's no longer going to be producing so many of the stuff that, you know, is now going to be made in Europe or the U.S.?
That's why China's been in some, you know, had a problem the last couple of years, because this is, we've started, that's why look at Mexico, right? Look at the peso. You can see that we're starting to create a backup supply chain. Andrea Steffes talks about this in our book. So Andrea said, you know, the East-West supply chain that was incredibly fluid after COVID and after a multipolar world with the Suez Canal, you've got drone attacks in the Suez Canal. All these things in a multipolar world where it's more global conflict, less friendly sea lanes, it's more inflationary. And so China, we've already seen so far Mexico benefit from this potential. Andrea Steffes in my book talks about a north-south supply chain that backs up the east-west. So basically the world got too addicted to an east-west supply chain. And so that's hurting China. That's why if you look at Latin American if you look at ETFs that just focus on LATAM, they're dramatically outperforming China. But the theory is that China's going to say, and reinvest at home and less in infrastructure and more, you know, try to create a real consumer-based economy. And that handoff is kind of unknown whether or not they're going to be able to pull it off. And that's one of the things that's causing this massive underinvestment the last year and a half. De-investment, I guess people moving away from China.
Right. So you said Latin American stocks are outperforming China. I imagine a huge reason that is just the Chinese stocks have been in a brutal, brutal bear market. To any, you know, anyone trying to pick a dip has just gotten destroyed. And so some of the companies look, you know, at least optically cheap. A lot of folks are worried about a Chinese recession, where even though growth looks good now and real growth looks good, they're building and their investment in real estate has really slowed down, and their economy has been very dependent upon that. What are your thoughts on that? And I mean, do you think China will be successful in attempting to move towards a more consumption-driven growth model where the savings rate basically goes down and its citizens save less money and they spend more of it, which will fuel growth, instead of having to have them save money and then, you know, funnel that to the government or banks, which then invest in real estate projects, which are getting increasingly unproductive?
Yeah, so China's a tough one, because the contrarian in me, and we run a Bloomberg chat with institutional investors in about 20 countries, and there's a number of investors that were really bearish on China that are now bullish because the lack of the underinvestment is so off the charts. I mean, I know personally a couple of different fund managers that run portfolios, major portfolios that people know about and are very well high branded names. And so when they go over to Europe or they go to conferences, normally there's like, you know, standing room only, they run out of coffee and muffins. And now, you know, my friend just got back from Europe and he runs a China fund and he's like, you know, there's four people in the room and they've got plenty of bagels, muffins and coffee. So it's tough because it's 14 trillion of GDP and it is growing, just not growing as fast, but it's hard to calculate, you know, the rate of growth because nobody can trust the data. But these companies are just so cheap. I mean, and that's why Charlie Munger was, before he passed away, of looking at stocks like Alibaba. I mean, at one point in the last year, you could fit 14 Babas in Apple. And people are talking about like, oh, there's China economic risk to Alibaba. I mean, who are you kidding? I mean, Apple does $20 billion a quarter of sales in China, $80 billion a year. And that's actually down 3% year over year. So Apple's performance over the last couple of months, which is really bad, Apple started to really, that whole China thing is starting to catch up with Apple. And then if you look at NVIDIA, the whole invasion of Taiwan thing from China has been out there and everybody talks about it. But there doesn't have to be an invasion. China just could literally create a naval blockade. And NVIDIA, like NVIDIA's got all this technology. Like I said, 5%, think about passive investing, how dangerous. 5% of all American IRAs, there's $35 trillion, Jack, that's tied to passive investing. Maybe more, probably more, if you calculate, depending on how you calculate it. And it's 5% of the S&P is in NVIDIA, which is trading at crazy valuations, you know, 82% above its 200-day moving average. And 5% of everybody's retirement account is in NVIDIA that is massively exposed to, it's a fabulous company, a semiconductor maker. So if something would ever happen in Taiwan, NVIDIA would get cut down by 60, 70, 80%. And China doesn't have to invade. They just have to maybe get just concerned about the amount of technology that is coming out of Taiwan and helping the United States. I mean, if you were China, wouldn't you, you know, at some point potentially want to do something about that if the U.S. is really gaining a technological advantage? So they could create a sea lane restrictions, or they can try to create all kinds of restrictions on what type of technology is coming out of Taiwan. That's probably the first thing you do before you invade, right?
Larry, is NVIDIA a bubble?
Well, the point of my book is the Bitcoin NVIDIA thing is pure idiocy because it just doesn't work without a power grid. It doesn't work without a very cheap energy source. And so artificial, it's just like the .com thing. I created a website. We talked about this in my first book, but my partner, Steve Siefel, and I, we created convertbond.com. We were lucky enough in the 90s to sell it to Morgan Stanley. And it was a nice transaction. But, you know, back then, the most obvious trade, Jack, that all the young people and almost every investor was involved in, were the obvious trades like Lucent, JDS Uniphase, Cisco, and Global Crossing. And these companies were like the obvious trades, like just like the way NVIDIA is today. But it's the second and third tier trades that nobody feels like natural gas or like biotechs, companies that are going to benefit from this new artificial intelligence revolution. So is it a bubble? Yeah, it's a bubble in the sense that everybody's crowded into the most obvious trades and nobody really owns the trades that are going to benefit from artificial intelligence for the next 10 years.
NVIDIA's doubled its revenues. At what point did NVIDIA become a bubble? Because it, you know, went to 400, it looked overvalued, but then it doubles its revenue. So, I mean, do you think that it will just, the spectacular growth will stop? And I guess you kind of think it's the poster child for speculative activity in growth stocks, which are overvalued relative to commodities.
The NVIDIA management team is famous for, I mean, these guys are pump artists. They literally 2 years ago, the conference call, not even a year, first of all, they didn't buy any of their stock a year ago. And the first, you look at the fourth quarter of 20, say first quarter of 23, fourth quarter of 22, very little stock. And so they were pumping meta chips. They were pumping crypto chips a year and a half, 2 years ago. No mention, you know, no mention of artificial intelligence. And so now they're going to be very careful with these guys. They tend to very overpump a upside of a bull market, which is fine. A lot of companies do that, but that's what they do. And so when you pump up something like this, and then you look at the circular revenues that come, like if you look at Facebook, how much Facebook spent and how much of Facebook's CapEx budget went to NVIDIA, it's very clear that these companies really aren't using these chips yet. They're just hoarding them because they want to prevent their competitors from getting an advantage in artificial intelligence. And so everybody's like trying to front run the other guy. And if electricity, if you just look at electricity usage, you know, last like 3-4 months, we don't really see, you know, a massive explosion yet in electricity usage from artificial intelligence yet. So you see it, but it's not like, it's nowhere near what NVIDIA's growth rate is. So there's clearly hoarding going on, and it's basically a circular thing where the FANGs, certain members of the Mag7 are like trying to front run the next one. And all the time these chips get higher and higher in price, it just incentivizes all the competition to invest. So their moat that everybody talks about is just going to get smaller and smaller and smaller. And at $2.3 trillion, trading 82% above the 200-day moving average, Apple in its best day, Jack, in its best day, September 2020, when it was at $2 trillion. So don't think of it, NVIDIA in a stock price, right? That's always think of it as like market cap. So when you get at $2 trillion, it's very difficult, Jack, because GDP is only certain size, right? It's very difficult when you get to $2 trillion, $2.3 trillion for NVIDIA. So to the most Apple got above its 200-day moving average when it was $2 trillion was like 63%. And the most Amazon got up to $2 trillion. Amazon, think about Tesla, never really reached $2 trillion. That was the big, you know, fair-haired boy, right? So Amazon really never cracked $2 trillion. These are really great growth stocks, right? And so Amazon, the most it ever traded, Jack, above its 200-day moving average was 54%. And when it was that big, right? So my point is, when you have a $2.3 trillion company that's 80% above its 200-day, it's a screaming sell. It just literally, there's not enough. It's all call buying. It's not real. It's not like real pension funds are buying it up there. It's just a bunch of speculators that are all trying to buy calls. When someone buys a lot of, we have like 3,000 people in one day buy calls, to give you an example. You know, the street has to like buy stock to hedge. If you're a dealer, you get lifted on those calls, and then you have to buy stock to hedge those calls. And so that creates this what we call this blow off top. And I think NVIDIA, remember, two Fridays ago, NVIDIA had a $250 billion candle, Jack.
That's from top to bottom in a day.
In a day. I think it was like within 2 days, it was like 13, 14%. And that, so over the period, it was even bigger. But the single day candle was like $240 billion. So that's nothing's even close to that. I mean, that's like the size of most of the companies in the S&P are less than that, right? You know what I mean? So right. it's just an obscene amount of speculation.
Like gold did, Bitcoin is establishing itself as a macro asset that potentially helps hedge against the government devaluation of your money. Finally, you can easily access Bitcoin in a low-cost ETF with the VanEck Bitcoin Trust, ticker HODL. Search the ticker HODL in your brokerage app today. Visit VanEck.com/HODLFG to learn more. That's VanEck.com/HODLFG. Now the disclosures. Investing involves risk and you could lose money on an investment in the VanEck Bitcoin Trust, also known as the Trust or HODL. The value of Bitcoin and therefore the value of the Trust shares could decline rapidly, including to zero. You could lose your entire principal investment. For a more complete discussion of the risk factors relative to the Trust, carefully read the prospectus link below. Thanks, let's get back to the interview. Larry, I'm just kind of putting the puzzle pieces together. NVIDIA is 5% of the S&P 500. Apple, other tech stocks, really dominate the S&P 500. As you say, energy, 3-4%, materials, you know, a small percentage of a fraction. So if the things that you think will outperform, energy, gold miners, commodity producers, are so small within everyone's investments, and those are going to do well, but they're small. So whereas so much of the S&P 500 is things you think might not do that well, you talked about NVIDIA, which you said is the screaming sell. Would that lead you to be bearish on the entire index because what you think will underperform just is so large as a percentage of the index? And okay, great, you love energy stocks and you love gold miners, but what, there's one gold miner in the S&P 500 and there's you know, only a handful of energy companies and material copper producers and the like.
Well, so think of the last time we had a, you know, multipolar world commodity bull market, 1968 to 81. So 1968 to 81, multipolar world, we had a commodity bull market in there. And so industrials, metals, oil and gas, uranium, that, those groups, materials, those groups were 49% of the S&P, 49. Now they're like 14. So your industrials, your metals, your oil and gas, your materials, all those are like 14% of the S&P versus 49% in, say, 1980, 81. So with the highest conviction, and that's why you have to buy this book to prepare yourself, we're probably going back to like, you know, 30% of the S&P, 32, not 49, but those groups are going to command a much larger percentage of the S&P. And right now, and that's what we've seen, like in all crazy bull markets, like 2007, look how big the financials were as a percentage of the S&P, 2007, 2008. They were enormous. I think it's like, and I think it was something like mid-20s. And so maybe mid to low 20s. And that's still an enormous amount for the financials. And so in different bull markets, energy at one point in time was, you know, a very high percentage of the S&P. Like ExxonMobil was the largest stock in the S&P. So you have these periods where they go on for long periods of time, and we've gone through a very long, that's my whole point in the book. We go through a very long deflationary, disinflationary period. And if inflation normalizes at 3-4% versus 1-2, that's what triggers, you know, a lot of this migration. Like I said, it's not going to go to, you're not going to see these things go back to 49% of the S&P, but they go from 14% of the S&P to 30, 32, 35. Yeah.
So you said inflation settling out at 3-4%. So mildly higher than the double the Fed's target of 2%, but you don't think that there will be sustained, you know, 9%, 10%, double digit inflation like we saw in the 1970s. Although that is of course possible.
In the book, I'm careful around that. I think it's possible, but there's a lot of factors, aging population in the world, aging population in China and certain countries that might prevent that crazy, you know, 9%, you know, a sustained 7%. And by the way, I mean, you look at history, civilizations break down after, like, because people don't understand, like, if you bought $100 worth of groceries in 2019, that you, even though inflation's come down a little bit over last year, that $100 of groceries in 2019 is like still $125. So in other words, it breaks down a society. That's why the bottom 30% of Americans, the New York Fed told us they only have $400 in their checking account, right? And so the higher inflation goes, the more support you need. And it's one of the reasons why I look at these student loan things, right? So this is what we talk about in the book. If the government all of a sudden giving student loans or providing, look at SNAP benefits, look at the percentage of Americans that are getting SNAP, that's food stamps. It was like 3-4% of Americans in, say, the 90s or even 2000. Now you're up near 13-14% in some parts of the country. And so your social safety net in an inflationary regime, for a whole bunch of different reasons, gets a lot heavier. That creates more demand for federal spending. At the same time, your interest costs are high. The bottom line is the only way to get out of a $35 trillion hole where your social safety net is a lot larger and your debts are that high, $35 trillion hole, is what we call financial repression. And that's what we talk about in our book, When Markets Speak. And it's number one on Amazon right now in finance and all the financial categories. You're going to buy it today, because what's about to happen is this financial repression decade where the Fed's going to get forced to hold interest rates below the rate of inflation. And that's where you get, if you're holding your interest rates below the rate of inflation, that's where you get a very substantial, that's the way they get rid of the debt. So what we talk about in the book is, and you and I have talked about this in the past, debt jubilee. Mm-hmm. So you go back the last 3,000 years of civilizations, people get rid of debt by what we call debt jubilees. They just do a debt reset. The other way for a civilization to get out of this kind of hole is what we call financial repression. And that's where you at some point the Fed gets forced to hold interest rates down. We're gonna, by the end of this year, we're gonna have to go back to QE. So what we talk about in the book is we're gonna have to go from QT, quantitative tightening, to QE very fast, because we've got less friends buying our bonds in the world. The US economy is slowing down a little bit, but our interest costs are now $80 billion a month. $80 billion a month. That's up from $25 billion a month 2-3 years ago. And so $80 billion a month starts to really eat up at a lot of the budget. And so at some point, the Fed gets forced into financial repression where you're holding interest rates below inflation. And that's the way you get out of a $35 trillion debt hole. A $35 trillion is a very enormous hole, and you get out of it through financial repression or a debt jubilee.
And the way that you get out of very high nominal debt is just by holding interest rates lower than inflation or lower than growth. So the denominator grows. And, you know, likewise, just to explain this to the audience, like, people can put up a very scary looking chart of credit card debt in the US. But if you divide it by personal income or GDP or any sort of denominator, what used to be a very high level debt is now not. So that you got to always adjust things. So Larry, you know, I've had people come on my program, very smart people, and talk about this financial repression narrative. When interest rates were at zero and inflation was going up, they said, oh no, the Federal Reserve, they can't raise interest rates that much because there's just too much debt. But here we are at 5.5%. You know, as you notice, S&P stocks at all-time highs. No imminent sign of crisis on the fiscal front. If you think inflation is going to be at 3-4%, and the Fed Reserve is at now at 5.375% on the Fed funds rate, likely has indicated that's going to do 3 cuts to below 5% by the end of this year. What is the sort of real, i.e., inflation adjusted level of interest rates that would have to exist to inflate away the debt? Because let's say inflation is at 3.5%. If interest rates are at 3.5%, you're flat. Maybe that's not enough to inflate away the debt.
Well, the modern monetary theory crowd, and I think Trump is a closet MMTer, they think that, yeah, if you do enough fiscal, or if you do enough, say, tax cuts. This is another crazy thing about Trump. If Trump wins the election, he wants to basically extend those tax cuts from 2017, tax cut 2017, I think they were passed. And so maybe 2018, but those tax cuts, if he extends it for 10 years, that's $350 billion. It's a large amount of money. And so it just gets into a dynamic where, and then he wants to cut the corporate tax. So if you're growing it, if you were to be able to cut taxes, or you were able to do a lot of fiscal spending, and you can grow at 7%, that's one way to get out of this mess. It's a big gamble, because if you do that, if you do it now and you say that's what Biden essentially is doing, but he's not doing it through tax cuts, he's doing it through spending. So there's two ways to do it, MMT, modern monetary theory. One is, just juice your fiscal stimulus. I mean, Biden's doing $2 trillion a year of deficit spending, which is almost 6% of the budget. Normally in a peacetime, full employment, well, not, I shouldn't say peacetime, but full employment, that should be, 2-3% of the budget. And so we're doing these, both presidents are potentially doing this gamble, which is very dangerous, because if you spend that much and you don't get the growth, then you go into a real financial repression regime.
That financial repression regime you envision with, let's say, inflation is at 3.5%, at what level of nominal interest rates would you start calling financial repression? 2%, i.e. negative real rates of 1.5%. What do you think?
If inflation's 4 and real rates are 3, mm-hmm. then you're in that neighborhood. But it's a very weird science, because there's some historical data around it. But picking what is financial repression? The bottom line is that the definition is just holding rates below inflation. So just say keeping rates at 3 when your inflation's 4. And so there you're in, you're slowly monetizing the debt.
So the Federal Reserve indicated it plans on 3 interest rate cuts this year. Would you say that what's currently priced into the forward interest rate market curve, let's say with a 2-year is where it is, do you think the Federal Reserve is going to go cut more or less than expected over the next 1-2 years?
Well, there's a couple of answers to that. One is, I think my big thesis that we talked about a little bit in the book, but I'm more confident now than ever. The oil market's pretty tight. The curve recently went in backwardation again. So your backwardation just means your front months are higher than your outer months. The major thesis at the end of the book, and the major thesis, I think it's going to play out this year, where high conviction thesis in when markets speaks is that if the oil market's so tight and the labor market, supposedly even a decent economy, especially in the high end where a lot of travel, and you got a tight oil market, you can look at backwardation, the oil curve, and all that means that the front months more expensive than the outer months, that typically bullish seasonality is coming back. Oil's performance between March and say September is pretty very good. You got a summer driving season coming in, and you've got global demand coming back. So if you get a $20 move in oil, because of where rates are and inflation expectations, all of a sudden everything around rate cuts now is comes into question, because oil goes up, it's going to take up CPI again. So you have this big inflation revival. That's where your interest rate sensitive stocks, like your regional banks, I think that there's, if you look at New York Community Bank, Jack, and we talk about this in the book, When Markets Speak, but the way they marked the book and the way the stock, you know, went to zero that fast, and same thing around Silicon Valley Bank, these banks just have horribly mismarked books. And right now, after what's happened at Silicon Valley Bank and New York Community Bank and Signature Bank, you've got regulators that have with egg on their face, Jack, and they're looking around the country for the next victims. And if right now, if you just look at Comerica, you look at Zions, you look at a whole bunch of different banks, look at U.S. Bancorp, all these banks have departments that are massively long commercial real estate, massively long mortgage-backed securities, all kinds of interest rate-sensitive assets. And if rates don't come down, you've got CFOs and financial teams in these organizations that have just been really begging the Fed for rate relief. It's one of the reasons why the Fed, you know, has been turning dovish, because they know they could create not a Lehman event, but definitely an S&L crisis event. And so that's the thing about oil, is oil and drones potentially have colossal impact on the banks, because drone strikes hitting refineries, drone strikes, you know, basically closing down transport in the Suez Canal, oil demand, you know, it's like a 1960s, 1980s world, multipolar. You get that move up in oil, and all of a sudden the long end of the curve, the Fed loses control of that. And next thing you know, there's an Apple bond, Jack. You got to focus on this. There's an Apple bond that's backed by Apple, and it's a long duration bond. So it's long maturity. It traded in the last like 6 months, 9 months. It's traded in the last 6 months and 56 cents on the dollar.
Because of duration. Yeah. But it's not credit. It's all duration, right?
It's all duration. Yeah. Well, that's the problem with commercial real estate. You've got credit and duration. And so if you have that kind of an energy move, the probability that we lose a Comerica or a Zions and have another kind of banking crisis, I think it's pretty high.
That is really interesting, Larry. So there was a time when interest rates were at zero, when, you know, everyone who would go on TV, not you, but, you know, most people who go on TV to talk about banks said if interest rates rise, it would be good for banks because their loan yields would go up more than deposit costs. Because it would happen so fast and we went from zero to 5.5 in, you know, a little over a year, but it seems like the blink of an eye, as opposed to the previous rate hiking cycle, which was very, very slow, a lot of banks' net interest income suffered. So do you think that basically the correlation between bank stock, let's say, you know, a financial stocks ETF and a basket of banks and interest rates is basically negative? In other words, as interest rates go up, the bank stocks go down.
Yes. What we've seen, and we talk about this in the book, When Markets Speak, the performance of the banks this year. And remember, there's two different types of banks. The regional banks are tiny, right? But companies like U.S. Bancorp are the fifth largest bank in the United States. And Comerica and Zions, these are not little tiny banks. But these banks, the performance of these banks since last January, so a little bit more than a year, you're underperforming the S&P by 50%. Between 30 to 50%. Like, that's something you've never seen outside of a financial crisis. And I was in a meeting yesterday with a big hedge fund in New York, and I'm staying here at the Harvard Club, as I told you. You know, we're doing events. I'm on the road. And so this dynamic is like, you know, you have banks that are mismarking their books. There's a lot of interest rate stress there. And clients are talking about that. And they think that the regulators are going to go after this problem if rates don't come down. And so people are looking like hedge funds, pension funds. Hedge funds are really starting to circle the wagons. And the underperformance of the banks over the last, you know, 12 to 16 months speaks to, you know, this piranhas of shorts coming in, and they're trying to find the next victim.
So Larry, if you're seeing a lot of inflationary pressure, which means that, you know, spending and investment, at least in nominal terms, will be pretty high, I think. Maybe in real terms, maybe not so much, but in nominal terms, it will be. Does that mean that you are not that worried about a recession? Because, you know, in a recession, inflation tends to fall or even go negative, as in the case of deflation. So, you know, an inflationary decade, maybe it's not a great time because prices are going up, but it would not be one in which there is a deflationary recession, almost by definition.
Right. And that's exactly what's going on. All the economists like Rosie, Lacey Hunt, I mean, these are great, great guys, and Raoul Paul. And so Rosie and Lacey have been extremely bond bullish because they're thinking, they're using that kind of recency bias where if the economy starts to slow down a little bit in 2008, you know, that 2008 and also in, say, 2020, in both of those situations, the long end ripped and you get this incredible rally in bonds, right? But this time around, because the fiscal and monetary is $16 trillion versus $4 in the previous regime, and because of all the things that are going on with labor unions and, like I said, multipolar world and global conflicts with wars, you've got all this upward pressure. And so you're not getting that typical, as we soften, the economy softened a couple times in the last year, and we didn't really get that big bond rally. Now, this is where you got to think about the 1980-style recession. So when a 1980-style recession is not that, is more like when inflation rips. See, right now, inflation's ripped, and it's hurting the bottom 50, 60% of people. You could see it in McDonald's numbers recently. You could see it in pet care. You could put so many companies, Dollar Tree stores. There's so many companies that are suffering. Kohl's, I mean, just company after company after company that sell products to the bottom 60%. But companies that sell products to the top 20%, 40%, 30%, your Ferraris of the world, your LVMHs. I mean, these stocks have gone on incredible runs. Your American Express versus, say, Discover. These are huge divergences, right? So it's just boom, 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 where it's the top group is actually in a bull market economically. The bottom 60% are in a bear. But if inflation rips one more time, then what happens in like a 1980 style recession is it basically starts to move up from lower middle class to middle class, and then eventually gets to the upper class. So at some point, but you think about it, if you're in Palm Beach, Jack, Palm Beach, and you have, say, this is, you know, a high net worth person, but just to keep it simple, you had $10 million in a money market fund, right? Powell just gave you a 300-400% raise because you were getting 70 to 80,000 a year in 2021, and now you're getting 500,000 a year, right? 450. So that is making, you know, you're going to travel with that money. You're going to revenge shop, and that's why you get all this wacky data in the economy. It's so obvious, Jack. It's just like, because half the you know, that top 20% of people, of husbands and wives and children, they're doing revenge travel, revenge shopping. They just have extra money that they never had when the Fed was suppressing rates. Never had it before in terms of that incoming interest. But the bottom 30% that, according to the New York Fed, according to them, not me, the bottom 30% of Americans only have $400 in their checking account for emergencies. Those people are getting annihilated. And that's why in an election year, there's so much pressure on the Fed to cut rates. And that gets back to, if they cut rates with inflation starting to bounce, that's going to just drive money. So that's what's going to trigger this colossal migration of capital. One of the biggest trades of our lifetime in When Markets Speak. Buy the book today on Amazon.
Larry, But the final question I want to ask you about is a topic you address in the late part of your book about the future of the U.S. dollar as the world reserve currency. It currently is and has been. Foreign countries own a lot of U.S. dollar reserves, foreign exchange reserves, in order to protect their exchange rate. And the dollar is used very frequently as an invoice of trade in oil, for example. That system, with all its blemishes, has held in there and has been very stable, very persistent, despite many people's predictions for like 40 years that it would collapse. What is your view on the future of the U.S. dollar and the U.S. dollar as the world's reserve currency?
Well, listen, the U.S. is not going to lose its status as the reserve currency in my lifetime. I don't know about yours, you're a little younger. The bottom line is, what we talk about in the book is, when you use the club, imagine like a bully club of sanctions, and you're supposed to use this club once every 10 years. But when you use it over and over again, you hit multiple countries over the head, you just build up a resistance of countries, and all the other emerging market countries are looking at you, hitting those countries over the head, bully club. I mean, you take Russian assets, Putin's a bad guy, you're going after oligarchs, you're seizing Russian capital. So that's driving people into things like Bitcoin and hard assets. And so you can say that the dollar has been strong, but the dollar's only been strong because the Fed's holding that front end up, right? Because the 6-month T-bill's paying 5%. That's sucking dollars into it, right? But the moment the Fed starts cutting in a multipolar world with high sanctions and everything we're seeing around global trade and confiscation of capital after the tragedy in the Ukraine with Russia, the dollar is going to come get hammered. And so that's why the dollar is essentially being held up by the Fed. Now, does the dollar lose its reserve currency? No, but remember, the oldest democracies, and this is what we talk about in the final chapters of the book, the oldest, like think about Tocqueville and Tytler. This is a Scottish historian, Tytler. He goes back to Tocqueville and Tytler, go back to the 1800s, late 1700s, 1800s, and they looked at democracies. And you know what? You look around the world at you look at Argentina, you look at Venezuela, Puerto Rico is a U.S. territory, but you can just see there's lots of societies that haven't lasted very long once the citizenry figures out that they can drain the public treasury. And you look what's happening in Washington, when we're promising people that come into the country for 5 minutes, a huge goodie bag, right? And so we weren't doing that like 150 years ago. And so if you're doing that kind of deficit spending and you're raiding the treasury, you're building up the debt to unsustainable levels, that's why democracies don't last. And the last thing I'll say is the cycles of democracy that Tocqueville and Tytler talked about was countries typically start off in bondage. And think about that's where the U.S. was during the Revolutionary War, where we were under the thumb of the king, in 1773, 4, 5. And then, you work out to patriotism, entrepreneurship, abundance. But then as the country flourishes, you come into this, what we call generational problem, where the next generations are not as hungry. They need to be accommodated. Next thing, you need to go into complacency and apathy, and then back to bondage. And this is a cycle that has repeated itself many times in the last, 2,000-3,000 years. And so, and if you look at the United States today relative to where it was, say, 50 years ago, you can definitely see traces of this cycle. And so eventually, in the next 50 years, we probably lose that reserve currency status.
You see a slow erosion of the dollar, but more in the short to mid-term, you are much more concerned about the level of the dollar relative to other fiat currencies than you are about the relevance of the dollar. In other words, the decline of the U.S. dollar as a reserve currency, that's a very long-term story. Short-term, you're a dollar bear, but you don't think that it's, going to be eroded anytime soon.
Exactly. No, yeah, short-term is just, the dollar's been on the high horse for a long time now, two, three years. The Fed's been, because the Fed, when remember, one great lesson in investing, we talk about this in the book, there's different ways to figure out the dollar. When the Fed is more hawkish or holding up rates relative to the other central banks, that's a big factor in the dollar. And that's what's been happening. But the other factor is if the U.S. economy's you know, much stronger than the rest of the world. And that was the case, you know, say a year and a half ago, last year, you know, that's also helping the dollar. But once the Fed, because it's holding up rates for so long and hurting, you know, so many people that are in the bottom 60%, and once they're forced to cut because of all kinds of things like the regional banks, then the dollar really gives way pretty quickly. And so there's two trades. There's the short, the 1-3 year trade of the dollar, and then it's the long term trade of the dollar.
And do you think the Federal Reserve will cut more or less than, let's say, the European Central Bank? Because I know in the past that the you know, U.S. interest rates were allowed to be higher than Europe, which, you know, in some cases, maybe because, you know, for reasons we won't get into, is like less productive. Japan as well. I mean, like, do you think that you know, if the euro is going to strengthen against the dollar, is it because ECB, your European Central Bank, interest rates are higher than the Federal Reserve, or is it for other reasons?
Well, hey, listen, the U.S. has a banking system that's more sophisticated. We've got leveraged finance, leveraged loans, CLO. All of our financing is more sophisticated than Europe. That's a huge part of why the U.S. has been a far, far, far superior economy. And our government's been typically less, you know, less big and less onerous than a lot of the European countries. But that's becoming less of the fact. But the Fed's at a period where the U.S. economy and the banking system is probably more vulnerable now. The population in election year is more vulnerable. That's one thing Powell has to deal with. So in an election year with a banking problem, that, you know, with a commercial real estate problem and all this debt, you know, that's on the bank balance sheets, they, you know, they really have a problem, and they got to get rates down. And I think that's where you could have some like a year from today, probably at least 100 bips of cuts, and then that gets you a much weaker dollar.
And so, do you think the European Central Bank will also have 100 bips of cuts, or more, or less?
You know, I think I would say probably half of that.
Got it. Thanks. Larry, the book is How to Listen When Market Speaks, Risk, Myths, and Investment Opportunities in a Radically Reshaped Economy. We will put it on stage there. My final question for you, Larry, and I promise you that this is the final one, the topic about when markets speak, there are two ideas in there. One of them is that, you know, I know at Bear Traps Report, you've got, what is it, 21 indicators, and how you're constantly interpreting what the market is telling you. So that's one idea. You've got to always pay attention to the market. That might be, you know, summarized by the short saying, like, the market is always right, or something like that. How do you square that with being able to spot turning points that, you know, by definition, you're going to be a contrarian? If energy is 3% of the S&P, and there's one tech stock, NVIDIA, that's more than that, wouldn't listen to when markets speak say, hey, actually, you know, isn't it a version of the efficient market hypothesis? And basically, it's the market's always right. In other words, you know, how can you try and be a contrarian and, you know, bottom tick those oil stocks in April of 2020 when they're trading at you know, a few pennies, you know? And how do you be a contrarian while also, like, paying attention to what the market is speaking to you?
Well, the first couple things is that when the transports and the banks are not acting well, something's wrong. That's listening to the market. Like, that's, there's something going on around energy prices and rates that has started to really hamper parts of the U.S. economy. So everybody's pretty bullish on the U.S. economy now. But for my lifetime, and every, just look back in history, when the transports are underperforming the S&P by 18%, I think, over 2 years, and the banks are underperforming by 20 to 40%, in some cases 50%, that means there's an interest rate problem in there, or an oil problem, or inflation problem. There's something, just look at FedEx, UPS. I mean, just seeing that, you're seeing some crazy performance there. And so it's, those things tell you that something's wrong in the market. Now, in high yield and triple C's, you've got a lot of private credit bubble right now. And so high yield has not broken down. And high yield's typically a much, you know, very good leading indicator on the economy. It's typically one of the best. And so we're not seeing strong signals there yet, but we are seeing strong signals on all the consumer finance plays. Any company that faces the bottom 60% or the bottom 50% of consumers, there's just dozens and dozens and dozens of them that have shown tons of stress. and tons of problems, or just, you know, earnings warnings where the CFO is just not comfortable with the guidance. So that's what we mean about how to listen when markets speak. In terms of being contrarian, what we try to do is, you know, we were buying a lot of these uranium names, 2020, 21. We look at bear markets, and bear markets typically, that's why we call it the bear trap support. Typically, bear market rallies fade and fall. In other words, say uranium, the uranium sector, those stocks for years were in this long decline and every rally failed. And so what we look for are those turning points where you're entering a new bull market, and we're trying to discover those. And we discover those by talking to clients, talking to people in Washington. Okay, is there a change in energy policy? And then is there a change in the technicals where, you know, all of a sudden Cameco or NextGen or one of these uranium plays, you know, made that bottom and then is now making higher lows, right, for the first time in a decade. And that's what we're looking for, is how to listen when markets speak.
Thanks, Larry, for coming on. Pleasure to speak with you. People can find you at Convert Bond on Twitter. Hopefully, I will be able to interact with you again. My account is having some irregularities. Larry, thanks again, and thanks, everyone, for watching.
Thanks, Jack. All the best.
Thanks for watching. Remember to check out vanek.com/HODLFG to learn more about the VanEck Bitcoin Trust, ticker HODL. Reminder that Forward Guidance episodes are available on all podcast apps and on Twitter, where I post them regularly at JackFarley96. Thanks again. Until next time.